Okay. All right. Craig has joined. Welcome, everyone, back to the QS cast. I am Tarkan. I am joined by a super cool co-host tonight. We have Kip, everyone, ladies and gentlemen. I think we have ladies in the QS Discord. If we don't, I think we have one or two, though. Anyways, welcome, everybody. I've got Kip, who's joining us. You all might know Kip is an insider and a moderator in the Discord. He helps us make sure everyone is doing what they should do. And I'm sure you also know Kip as the kind of the, you're what, the high-end graded guy, Kip, I guess is how we can refer to you.
Yeah, Kip sort of,
So Kip pretty much, his sole focus in our world of magic investing and finance is basically high-end and graded. That's sort of his area of expertise. And considering everything that's been happening lately with that market sector and pricing and all the crazy high-end reserve list stuff, thought it would be a really good idea to have him come on and just kind of talk to us about that whole world, because I know it's a world that I'm not very familiar with, and I'm sure many of you may or may not be familiar with, but he's an expert. So yeah, Kip, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Obviously, people should know that my name is Adrian Kiddo. I'm originally from New Zealand and now live in Australia. And just
so we can, refer to you as Adrian then.
Yes, yeah. And a little bit of background. I started playing Magic in sort of very late 1994. I had the opportunity to buy revised or fourth edition on the shelf when I started. Revised was $20 and fourth edition was $5. So I made the very logical choice to buy four fourth edition boosters. So I've obviously opened them, played with pretty much all packs through the days. I've never opened an Arabian Nights booster. It's about the only thing that I've never opened through the days. I've also quit a couple of times, like a lot of people. So I have a daughter, and I quit Magic when she was born and then rejoined about a week before the Avacyn Restored pre-release. So everything I own in my collection, things like that, has been purchased since, I guess, whenever Avacyn Restored came out. What was that, 2011? Yeah.
Wow, cool. So you've been going at it since 2011. And have you always, since 2011, since you got back into it, did you move your focus to the high-end world from there, or did you sort of segue into that?
I think I could say that I started straight in high-end. I played the Avacyn Restored pre-release. Then on the store was closed on the Monday, and then I went to a different store on the Tuesday, walked in, and in the case they had a Black Lotus, and I thought, I wanted to own a Black Lotus, so I bought the Black Lotus. So my very first card, Magic card, when I rejoined Magic was a Black Lotus.
Something that I think not many of us can say that their first card rejoining the game was a Lotus.
Yes, that is, I think I'm a little unique in that respect. And then over the next 2 months, I completed out a set of Power 9. And then over the rest of that year, so this was sort of May, June, GP Auckland 2012 was coming up. And so I Googled what was happening there, and they went Vintage was going to be as a side event. Well, I had a Black Lotus and two Moxes by this point in time, so I decided to buy a Vintage deck. So then I proceeded to Google what was the best Vintage deck, and Chris Bakula wrote an article on Espresso Stacks, which was the hotness at that point in time, because Lodestone Golem was obviously out. And so I went and bought the entire 75 that he played to win a three or eight man or something like that in June 2012, and that was basically how I got back into Vintage, and how I discovered my love for Mishra's Workshop.
Do you still have that deck?
Yes. I almost exclusively play shops in Vintage. I still have all of my shops. The power has all changed since then. I've fully baited out my power since then, because I got to I bought the first eight of the Power 9, and then the only Time Twister I could buy was Beta. So I bought a Beta Time Twister and then went, well, one of these things isn't the same as the rest. So then proceeded to Beta out the rest of my power to match my Time Twister.
Wow.
I got, I got incredibly lucky along the way. So obviously I joined just before the, like during the middle of the explosion of people returning to the game. And I decided to upgrade all my power before Grand Prix New Jersey in 2014. So I did a deal with a dealer up in Boston, and I sent the agreement to post him my whiteboard of power, and then he'd sell it at Grand Prix New Jersey on my behalf, and then he'd put the money to whatever I owed him for the blackboard of power. And he had five Noxes and a Black Lotus. So I posted it away. That was the first of the big power explosions. And my whiteboard of power basically doubled between New Zealand and America. So I went from unlimited power to blackboard of power for about $300.
Wow.
Yeah,
so what is the value of your vintage deck? Let's start with that. We can use that as a segue to really jumping into how this whole market works.
So like if I was to play Ravager Shops right now, I have five Beta Moxes, Beta Lotus, four Shops in it. I guess that would probably be $35,000-$40,000 to replace. If I play Painter, which is what I sometimes play as well, we bring into play the Blue Power as well at that point in time, with the four Shops and all the Moxes, and it's probably a $50,000 deck to replace.
The price of your deck, this vintage deck, is literally the price of a car. You can buy a BMW for $50,000. That's incredible. So just so everyone has a sense of like what kind of value is really in this, you know, in the high-end market in this segment, it's pretty mind-blowing. So I mentioned, you know, in the start of this, I've never owned a piece of power. Just to be sort of put that out there. I have yet to this day, and I've been playing since the early days of the game, I have yet to own a piece of power. I'm just so, this whole world is, I'm familiar with it. I've seen it, obviously. I know how the general pricing of things, but it's just like a foreign land to me. So maybe you can just kind of start, like, how does that whole market work, and how does someone enter it, and is it really just the land of, is this where all the magic millionaires hang out, and it's sort of the 1%? Like, maybe you just kind of like give us some sort of an intro view into the high end world, and we can take it from
there. Well, I think one of the things that should be pointed out is there is sort of two to three different markets in that space. Your average vintage player probably relies on proxies very heavily, so they'll own. Normally, I would suspect that they normally own the core of their deck, and maybe two to five pieces of power. So if I look around me here in Australia, there is probably 10 powered players here in Melbourne where I live, as well as that on top of them, 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 that can land on his record build package there.
Kip, I think we lost you there for a second. Could you backtrack? You kind of broke up. Could you backtrack, go back to your statement?
Sure.
8 to 10 players in Australia.
I don't know, in Melbourne where I live. There's 40 to 50 powered players at least in Australia. We have a big event each year. It's called Masters. It's basically Australia's Eternal Weekend, but it's been running for about 12 years, so it actually predates Eternal Weekend. So of there's probably 10 players in Melbourne who are fully powered, and as well as that, there's probably another 10 players here who can have, they know where they get a Mox from, where they get a Lotus from, and things like that, so they can put together a deck for that event. We had 45 players for Sanctioned Vintage in June, to put it in perspective. So that's your average vintage player. Then there is guys like me who have spend a bit more, put a bit of love and effort into their deck, and they come in two forms. They come in the form like me, who like everything to be blackboard and original, and then there's the guys who foil their decks or foreign foil their decks. There is a guy in America who has a fully baited, foiled Japanese workshop deck. Just to put it in perspective, try finding a foiled Japanese Nemesis Tanglewire, and then find four. the love which some people put into their decks, and they really are works of love. Like, I'm a terrible Magic player, I really am. I suck at this game, so if I can't win, I want my deck to look good, and me to have a conversation with the person sitting opposite me about like the cards in play. And but I don't look down on somebody for at all. That's probably the other biggest thing. I just want to play the game, but I want to have a conversation with the person who's playing opposite me, and that's the way I engage with the game and the format. And then I said there was three types of people. So there's that one, and then the third part of particularly vintage players is the guys with monster collections. And I'm talking about, there's a guy on Twitter who has 70 pieces of power. There's a guy in America who has a guy in Scotland who has a playset of Beta Power, for example. These guys they're using it as both an investment vehicle and a way to build their way. And then after that, obviously, when you start getting into the really high end, there's people with graded power. So one of my friends owns a quad 9.5 Beta Black Lotus, for example. So he bought that for less than what it's worth today, and he's not aiming to sell it for any amount of time until it's worth a lot more than what it is today. So there's sort of, in the vintage high-end market, there's sort of four types of players and things like that.
So what I'm gleaning from the things that you're saying is that it's a community driven by mostly passion, less so financial motivation, right? And that it's a tiny community whereby a lot of you guys, it sounds like a lot of you guys know each other or know of each other. And that it sounds like if someone wanted to enter this market with other motivations than passion, it sounds like they could really seriously move this market and cause some shifts, right? Because it sounds like it's so small, but that generally doesn't happen because most of you guys are in this for the love. Is that correct?
Definitely. I use the term bottom. The first two categories I talked about, very much so. And particularly in the graded and high-end stuff, I think there's part of that happening at the moment. For example, in the graded group, there's a lady who has joined the graded group very recently, and I don't know if she even plays the game, but she has said that she only found out about Magic in January this year, and she's got the second best set of graded Arabian Nights, for example, in that time. She has bought multiple sealed beta boosters and starters in that time. So there is people entering the ultra high-end market, and I don't know whether they're buying to click to have a conversation or whether they're buying to use it as an investment vehicle in the midterm and things like that, because of the returns and some of that stuff has just been absolutely crazy in the last 12 to 18 months.
So let's talk about that. So given the sort of, I don't know, the axioms or given the conditions we just talked about, people, small community, people that are primarily driven by passion, what has gone on the past 12 to 18 months? What's suddenly happened from you being in that community and from what people are talking to the community? What was there a trigger? What happened that made everything just snowball and get so crazy? Because the prices have gone through the roof, and we can talk about this later. There's no sign of them slowing down, but what happened? What was the catalyst? What's been going on?
I think the biggest catalyst was the growth of old school. You've had a phenomenal amount of players who have rejoined the game in the last 5 years. They're people who like and want to re-engage with the cards that they knew when they were younger, and things like that. So, and it's sort of coalesced around, traditionally it used to be vintage, but vintage is just unaffordable. When a whiteboarded vintage deck costs $20,000 to play at a sanctioned level, old school, particularly American old school or the Eternal Central rules of old schools allowing I International Collector's Edition and Collector's Edition have really brought people out of the woodwork to play that. And they are driving demand at a grassroots for the cards. And that in turn pushes the MP prices up, which in turn pushes the near mint prices up. And when near mint prices up go up, graded cards go up. And the second part of that is you're seeing people who are moving from one to another. So as the price of jewels has gone up because of legacy action and things like that, people are moving their cards into power, which means that there's less power. Yeah, to put it in perspective, there is only 22,000 Black Lotuses ever printed. There's and things like that. So if you get these guys who are aging up or returning to the game, doing exactly what I did, walking in and going, I'd really like to own a Black Lotus, and buying it, that's one less on the market, because someone like me isn't going to release my Black Lotus back onto the market in any time of things. It's a beta Black Lotus sold on eBay this week for $14,700, a played beta Black Lotus. You could offer me that $14,700, and I'd sort of look at it and go, I don't really need 15 grand right now. I'll just keep my Black Lotus. And that's what's happening. Is you've got all these people, particularly, and I think I'm the perfect example of that. I'm 40 years of age. I have a wife, a child, a house, et cetera, and things like that. I don't need to move that money into another. In 10 years' time, I might want to move it into an investment. But why would I sell it now for $14,700 when I realistically think a Beta Lotus is going to be $30,000 in 5 to 10 years' time? Because so, people are aging up.
Right. So, okay. So, in your estimation and from what you gathered from being in the community, the popularization of old school kicked all this craziness.
Yes.
So, it wasn't investors suddenly going, it's time, or SCG or someone going, okay, time to move up. Suddenly there was this sort of slow and, you know, this trickle in of people trying to hoard and whatnot. It was play. It was old school. It was just playing the game and people coming back, nostalgia and whatnot, bringing them into old school, and that sort of caused this domino effect.
Yeah,
so
very much sorry.
So okay, now so let's say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, those people have sort of aged. Many haven't aged out of Magic, but you know they got their high from coming back into the old school and whatnot. Like. Is there going to be some other kind of catalyst? Because obviously the newer generation doesn't have the same experience with the old. You know, we talk about this all the time. The old schoolers have that experience with the old cards. The new schoolers don't have the same kind of relationship with the old cards. Some people might say they don't care as much, you know, outside the fact that they're really expensive and they're collectible. So do you think that this sort of massive the spike in prices that we saw is going to happen again by something else? Or do you think that was sort of a one-time, the conditions in the environment were correct for that to occur, and now it's just going to be, you know, over just natural, you know, over time collections, get a lot of cards, get a lot, you know, the supply slowly dwindles, and that's what causes prices to slowly creep, which was kind of what was happening before.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think too, major price increases in power. Grand Prix New Jersey and run into Grand Prix Las Vegas this year. And both of them had major catalyst events, which was around legacy events. And that's the biggest thing, I think, is if we see that perfect storm again, like we did this year, coming, and myself and Stu both called this out when they announced the Grand Prix circuit in October last year, both of us said jewels were going to go bonkers in the mid to late part of the first half of this year. And that was because there were six teams events, two Eternal weekends, and four SCG teams events, but it actually ended up being 10 SCG teams events, which is just going to put a massive amount of pressure on the legacy, on the jewels, and people turn those spears into power, which and things like that. So we've seen a very much an unprecedented jump. Well, actually, it was precedented. It was precedented by Grand Prix New Jersey in 2014. So we saw Grand Prix Richmond, which then became Grand Prix New Jersey, do the same thing. Grand Prix Richmond put the pressure on Fetchlands. Grand Prix New Jersey put the pressure on power. Now, until we see that again, we're not going to see this sort of spike in power again. But you are going to see slow burn. Like another example of that is CE sets. CE sets, I bought a CE set for a friend of mine for $3,200 Australia in November last year. That same CE set would be $10,000 US today.
Yeah.
But CE sets have very much slowed down. Like they were just growing, but now they seem to have hit that price ceiling of $10,000, so they're not moving. And the people are listing them for $12,000 in the high-end group at the moment, and they're not selling. So there is definitely pulled back a little bit. And until we see another pressure cooker type effect, and it'll be around legacy, I don't think we'll see a big spike again. but we will
now,
see
this
one.
Is it possible, because obviously this year has brought so much attention to, you know, your niche, your and your community, you know, obviously there's YouTube content creators, guys like Alpha Investments and whatnot, you know, there's several channels that talk extensively on this subject. Is it possible for an agent to, not saying it's going to go to them, but for some agent to come in and buy up these products and sort of force a new correction? Is that also a possibility? Or, you know, is this world sort of unique in the sense that that doesn't necessarily work? I would think that someone could if they wanted because of the scarcity, but I really, like I said, I don't know how the dynamics of the market.
Yes, you absolutely could, particularly in Arabian Nights, for example, or Antiquities. Some of those cards are, you know, they only have 20,000 copies. Some of them are only a few hundred dollars at this point in time. So buying all of them off the market could happen. And then, yes, somebody could artificially pressure the market. But the thing is, there is still a lot of these copies around out there. So when people talk about like the super rare comics, for example, a lot of people point to them, or I often point at, if people are going to be, how high can a Black Lotus go? I point at the T206 Horace Wagner card from cigarette collecting card from baseball. Those are 5 to 6 million US now each. But the thing is there isn't as many, there is only 30 or 40 of those known in the world versus, you know, as I said before, if you look at even Alpha Lotuses, there was 1,100 of them made. So the scales to buy them out to try and do a force correction on it would be very, very high. So yes, there is always the option for somebody to come in and wildly distort the market. But the problem is it comes into a liquidity thing. Like when you pump and dump on the share market, for example, it's very easy to sell the shares back. Like we saw in the cryptocurrency stuff in October through December last year, people were able to pump and dump within 6 hours. With Magic, you have to wait for it to be physically shipped to you. You have to get it, then you have to list it, then you have to wait for a buyer to come. Things you pump and dump in Magic is 6 weeks. And
right.
For the guys who are looking to do that to markets, that's just too long. There is also the other big problem is aside from the very first few sets, people can't actually know how many are still out there in markets. Like when you look at shares or look at cryptocurrencies, you can look at exactly how many are available on the market in any one day. Because with a cryptocurrency, I can say that there is, you know, 16 trillion Bitcoins ever made.
Yeah, right.
That's it. And things like that. Where with a lot of Magic cards, example of that would be Jihad. Jihad was spiked twice in the last 12 months. But the thing is, they keep turning back up on the market. Like even though every time they go up, because it's gone from being a $20 card to a $300 card, it incentivized people to go and dig them out of their bulk boxes, go and find them in their decks, or just go, this was sitting in a crap EDH deck, which I've played twice in the last 3 years. I'm just going to sell this card out. So more comes out of the woodwork because of the fact that that Magic players are incentivized to basically sell them, which means that somebody who is trying to just buy them out of the market would just have to keep buying. The time frame for someone to manipulate the market is very, very hard. Now, the second part of that is if you have a lot of people at your disposal, like, you know, obviously, the comment that was mentioned there, a YouTube content creator, they can name a card and it spikes. We know that.
Right.
But then again, it'll only stick at that price if people actually want to buy it. So if there isn't actually any demand for it, aside from the mint copies, you see the some play and the end plays just become a race to the bottom, basically, as people try and get their money back out to try and follow along the next fad. So yes.
So what's, I'm curious, what is the psychology of that, because we're all familiar with the race to the bottom and pump and dumps are risky, etc., in the sort of normal Magic world. But like in the high end community, is it almost like the community defends itself because that's very frowned upon, and if someone tries to do that, the community sort of retaliates and goes, oh please, you know, oh, there's a whale trying to mess around. Like, is that sort of how it works? Because, you know, in just the regular world of Magic, you know, somebody can go try and buy out a modern or random EDH card, and then you know, they don't really know what they're doing, but in the vintage community, you actually have access to a lot of the community itself, where they're communicating, where they're speaking with each other, and they're, you know, sort of talking regularly. Is that sort of, is there a psychology there where the community, there's sort of this groupthink where the community is like, well, you know, we sort of protect ourselves from any shenanigans?
There is definitely that in the old school community. When the sort of the August last year reserve list spikes were all happening, the old school community would often release a card from one player to the other at old prices or a depressed price underneath it. You know, there was a guy there who just needed his fourth Jihad, for example, to finish a set for a deck that he was building and things like that. So the community sometimes protect each other from that stuff. And then there's also the whole, we all look at it and go, that's not going to stick. Some of them you know are going to stick because they're actually played and things like that. But there is a little bit of that. The community protects themselves. When you're getting into the ultra high end, particularly the graded stuff, so there's a Facebook group for graded collectors. And it's used, I would suspect that a large number of the buy and sell stuff happens through that Facebook group. Obviously eBay as well. And I'll get into eBay in a bit. But we see people come in and try and name completely unrealistic numbers for cards. So somebody tried to suggest $75,000 for a BGS9 Beta Black Lotus a couple of months ago, or 6 weeks ago. And everyone just laughed at him because we know for a fact that one of the admins of the group was selling two BGS 9.5 quad plus lotuses for $42,000, like literally just a few days before. So you don't go from $45,000 or $42,000 to $75,000 in 6 weeks. That's Bitcoin inflation and things like that. In reality, that post is still up there and he's bumping it, trying to get sales offers and things like that. If he was realistic and asked $50,000 for that card, he'd probably be talked down to around the $45,000 mark and he'd have a sale overnight. But he's never going to get a sale at $75,000. And then often people point at there is an Alpha Black Lotus on eBay, for example, where a guy has listed up for, I don't know, 3+ years at $100,000. Well, the market's starting to get close to him. A nine Alpha Black Lotus is probably $35,000-$40,000 now. So, you know, when he started listing it at $100,000, the market was probably $10,000. So, you know, in time, the market will get to him, but it's a long time, and it's going to need an external pressure to do the next big jump.
So what causes external pressure on graded cards? So you're saying the only, because from the early part of the conversation, you mentioned that it was sort of this cascading thing where people moving into legacy, which causes people to move into power, et cetera, and then it reaches all the way up into graded. Is that pretty much the only way that it happens?
So actually, believe it or not, graded cards can go down as well, and I'll talk about that in a few seconds. Pressures on graded cards, the biggest one that we've seen in the last 12 months is PWCC, which is the people who sell graded cards, so they're called PWCCmarketplace.com. Basically, they just sell everything on eBay for $1 reserve. But the thing is, they have over 100,000 people that they send their marketing emails to when they're doing an auction, and they do between 11 and 12 auctions per year. And their level of professionalism is just phenomenal. So people submit to them, and they guarantee payment, basically, is the answer. So if your card sells, and then the buyer doesn't pay them for whatever reason, they still pay the person out. They also have this monstrous marketing machine. Once you've bought from them, you're emailing them their database and they send it out. And what we've seen is a lot of buyers crossing the threshold back into Magic with that. So if you look at the price of graded cards over the last 6 months, every single increase in graded cards has come along with a PWCC auction. And the biggest one was the Alpha 9.5 Lotus that was sold in the July auction. It went for $87,000. So that was a basic 9.5 Alpha Lotus. To put it in perspective, in sort of February, a quad 9.5 alpha Lotus was $65,000. So there's massive amounts of jumps there. Sorry, I use terms like quad and basic, by the way. So when you look at a graded card, if it's a BGS card, it has the big number, which is the final grade, and then it has four subs. If one of those subs is below the final grade, it's called a basic. And if one of them is, if they're all exactly at the final grade, it's called a quad. And then if one of them is above the final grade, it's called a quad plus, so plus above. So to put that in perspective, it was a 9.5, so it's got a gold label, but it had a 9. I seem to remember it was a 9 centering as well, which means that for the pure collector, they only want quads. So for a card to sell for $87,000 without a without even being a quad 9.5 was quite a big leap. When, as I said, in February, a quad 9.5 was worth $65,000.
So PWCC on eBay is one of the primary benchmarks for what the market prices are for these cards. And it's literally, sounds like, whenever the next guy with a bunch of money decides to outbid everyone else, that's when the price has now gone up. That's what it sounded like for graded. You know, like $87,000. So somebody was willing to pay $87,000. That is the new price. And the graded community, that's sort of where their foundation, their baseline. And at whatever point in the future, someone decides to drop $100,000, well, now the $100,000, right? Is that sort of the general way it works?
The biggest thing with auctions is you need two people who are willing to pay that price. So one's got to be the underbidder. If everyone else in the market thought that that card was $45,000, that guy would have won it for
$46,000. Right.
So that means that there's at least two people out there. Another example would be a Juzam Jin. So again, a basic 9.5 Juzams, PWCC in the same auction sold one for just over $5,500 when quads were $3,000 6 months ago. And then we saw two more sell just on eBay for $5,000 within 3 to 5 days after that. So obviously the underbidder went out and bought another one because it always needs two bidders to get to that price. And then somebody listed one up as like a $6,500 they wanted for it, and they accepted a best offer of $5,500. So the new price on a basic Juzam 9.5 is sort of around that $5,500 price. You know, we've had three sales of that things, and there is only 40 of these cards in the world. So when three of them move hands for the same price, you've got a new price baseline.
Right. And as you said earlier, the non-graded world can inform the graded world in the sense that things cascade into, you know, people move and kind of trade up, quote unquote. But the graded world does not necessarily inform the non-graded world in that a Juzam, a quad basic Juzam can jump up in price, but that doesn't mean that you need to extrapolate any kind of predictions for the non-graded world. Is that correct? It's kind of its own world.
Yeah, and there's weird distorting factors as well. Like there is some cards are very, very hard to get in high grades. Examples of that are like Alpha and Beta Dark Rituals. So there is only one 9.5 alpha Dark Ritual. There is only three beta 9.5 Dark Rituals. So that's a common. So the logic would be that there would be lots of them, but there isn't because they have a major centering issue on both of them. They also have, being the fact they are commons, they often weren't protected, looked after. Another example is Birds of Paradise. There's only one 9.5 Birds of Paradise in alpha and beta. There's only one quad 9.5, and it's an alpha, and believe it or not, and that card is notoriously bad for centered, but the 9.5 actually has a 10 on centering, so very rare beast.
Interesting. Okay, so it really is its own, it's its own thing. Like, graded is really its own separate world, and most of you guys in the grade, because you dabble in graded yourself, correct?
Yes, I have collection of just cards I like that are graded, and I'm like five cards off collecting a quad nine, but it'll be the first quad nine Arabian Nights set. So there's people out there who've got quad 9.5 sets. I decided that 9.5 was outside of my price and it was unrealistic for me to achieve, so I wanted a nine set. And then when I realized that there was no quad nine set in existence, I decided to be the guy who assembled the first one. And at this point in time, I'm the only guy because there is one card that only exists twice in Quad 9, and I own both of them.
So the graded community truly is like the smallest, most niche community within the sort of high-end sphere, it sounds like, right? Like,
oh, no, there's one above us.
Oh, really?
Original art.
Oh, yes. Okay, cool. Yeah, the art group, yes. Okay, but as far as like cards, printed cards, graded is sort of that's like the niche of the niche. And most of you guys at least have heard of each other, right? Like everyone that dabbles in that community pretty much knows each other, right? Or knows of each other.
Definitely up at the 9.5 level. So I sort of cross the bridge between 9 and 9.5 in the fact that I have a couple of friends who are at the ultra high end 9.5, 10 stuff. And so I'm often messaging people going, hey, like, do you want to talk to this guy for that? And things like that. I get nothing from that. I just help friends out. So and things like that. At the 9, there's a lot of graded sets that people don't know about, because there's a lot of people who had, say, a set of Antiquities, for example, when they've had it for many years, and they just paid and got the whole lot graded, and then they're just chipping away at filling the set out. Like, for example, like they might have got one card that got an 8. And then on eBay turns up the same card as like a 9. So they'll just buy it and things like that. So there's definitely those guys out there that nobody knows of. I also know that I've been outbid a couple of times. So I know there's two other guys who are trying to complete 9 sets for Arabian Nights as well. And I've been outbid a couple of times by a guy on eBay. And it's not either of those two guys. So there's definitely a third guy out there. That's what I'm trying to say. But, wow. But yes, you're right. The community is very small. Like, you know, people who are trying to collect Arabian Nights 9 sets, there's probably I know three of us, so there's probably one or two more out there. But yeah, it is a very small community.
I mean, you're talking about you're naming literally, you can count them on one hand, the number of individuals in the world that are messing or they're playing in this world. It's super fascinating. Okay, so those guys, let's say you and these high end graded guys, do you even care, or do they even care about what happens to the common world of magic? Like, magic, you know, Wizards botches the whole thing up and the whole enterprise goes belly up in an alternate universe. Does that matter to the greater world? Is the greater world just going to keep on plugging away with what it does?
Well, so obviously if magic died completely, it's going to hurt the things. But you got to remember that actually, so probably the single biggest thing that should be mentioned about graded is graded people traditionally only looked at Alpha, Beta, Arabian Nights, Antiquities, and Legends. It's sort of widened a wee bit more to Revise now. And then some people are grading right out to like Urza's Saga stuff and things like that. So it's predominantly reserve list focused sets, stuff with very low print runs and things like that, and often with poor quality control. So what happens in the modern world, what happens in the standard world, has zero impact at all on the graded people. Like, some people are grading expeditions, for example. There's about 300 in the population report, but it has such a little impact on, you know, to use a term from someone else, you know, ABU and the Four Horsemen. So being the fact that the Four Horsemen is a term used for Arabian Nights, Antiquities, Legends, and the Dark. The impacts on purely mint cards in that world, standard can never apply. I guess if someone reprinted if Blood Moon, for example, got reprinted in standard, would be a thing that could happen. And you know, because you might see some people who want to buy the old framed copies, and maybe some of the lower pop Arabian Nights or the Dark cards, if City of Brass, for example, went back into standard, might get cracked out. And when I'm saying lower pop, I mean grades like, you know, sixes, sevens, and eights, stuff that's probably going to come out of its case at some stage in its future because it's going to go into someone's deck. Example being, there was a guy who played an old school deck at Las Vegas and he cracked 73 of his 74 out of slabs. They were all 8.5s and 9s. Because he wanted a really mint old school deck.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. So you do think that if Magic were to go belly up, because the what's marketed, I shouldn't say marketed, that's sort of negative. What's promoted is that regardless of what happens to Magic, you know, the high end, the graded world is its own universe, and you know, it's just going to keep on trucking along and doing its thing. But it sounds like you made a small comment that you think that if Magic were to just die, that could affect that market.
Well, it has to. An external force is always going
but that's
to
not, but that's not what we're told, though. If you think about it, like, well, what's promoted everyone from a lot of the community is, you don't have to worry about it. Yeah, well, wizards can do whatever they want, and magic goes. Well, you know what? You know, the four horsemen are just going to, that stands the test of time, and we'll continue trucking along because it's been so long, and the collectors have so much invested. That's sort of what we're conventionally.
So it comes down to one of those short term versus long term. Do I think a Library of Alexandria is always going to have value even if Magic died for 10 years? Yes. Do I think a Library of Alexandria would have the same amount of growth that it has had, you know, even if you go year on year for the last 15 years, if Magic was to end today? No.
Sure.
So let's talk, you know, a graded 9.9 Library of Alexandria is about $2,500 today for a quad 9. It's probably grown a lot in value over the last 12 to 18 months. But if we went year on year from, say, you know, 2005 onwards, it's probably had 10% per year or something like that. If Magic stopped today, would I expect a 10% year on year return for the next 10 or 15 years? No. But if Magic is continuing, do I? Yes. So yes, I agree that the cards will have value regardless of what Magic does. Because old cigarette cards, old sports cards, the players are dead now, still right. Have value going forward. But do they have, you know, the growth of a Michael Jordan rookie card probably was much greater when Michael Jordan was still playing than when after he retired and things like that. Particularly because it was, you know, Michael Jordan rookie cards 10 years before Magic started out and things like
and
that.
And that's an interesting analog or analogy, because I would agree with you. Like I say that Magic may die in this, quote unquote, die in the sense that Wizard botches it or it gets bought or whatever happens and it stops being printed. But in my opinion, Magic as a game system will never go away because it's been a problem to the world. It's an awesome game system. It is what it is. People will continue playing it. Similar to baseball, right? Baseball is a game. While yes, baseball still exists, and it's, you know, some players have died off, but people still play baseball. Therefore, baseball cards are a thing, and they're legend. The legends of the game, those cards will always continue to go up in value, albeit maybe less than they did before. I think the same thing with Magic. I don't think Magic as a game will ever go anywhere. And even if Wizards were to stop printing cards, it will still be played, and therefore these cards will retain value.
Yeah, and the biggest thing is, coming back to touching on what you touched on earlier on, was people having the emotional attachment as well. So the guys who played in the 90s, I'm one of the youngest, turned 40, so a lot of them are 40 to 45. So when I say the 90s, I mean the very early 90s, early to mid-90s. And they're going to continue aging up until for another 10 to 15 years. The question happens is, in 15 years' time, when, you know, I say this quite regularly, you never underestimate the earning power and spending power of a male in his 40s. They are a powerhouse for earning money and spending money as well. Go look at Maserati, go look at Lamborghini, Ferrari, things like that. Or even actually touching on what you touched on before, BMW and things like that. The number of people who are driving those vehicles in their 40s because they saw them when they were growing up is, and that's the key words there, when they were growing up, drives a huge amount of those prestige sales to in the 40s and 50s. Now, when my age group gets to 60, are we still going to play Magic? Probably not. Are we still going to have collectibles? Probably. Are we going to release them back onto the market? Yes. The question is who's going to buy them? You know, because there will be a group of Magic players who've never seen a Black Lotus. In fact, I regularly get that. I get people who've been playing for 5 years and say to me, "Do you have a Black Lotus? I've never seen a Black Lotus." So the question is, will they have that? You know, Black Lotus is so unique, but they won't have the attachment, say, to Library of Alexandria, for example, because it's not that Black Lotus.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I sort of routinely talk about, you know, the new generation does not, they don't have the same relationship with cards as the guys from the 90s do. It's, everything's just different, right? And it's not a product of a mistake on Wizards or anything. We just live in different times, right? We live in the land of mobile games and millions more games, and gaming just blew up, right? Now, in my opinion, I think that the sort of explosion in gaming in general, I mean, gaming is, as a market, as a cultural phenomenon, is far and away completely different and so much bigger than it was in the 90s, right? I mean, it's a cool thing now. So I think that works in Magic's favor, in the sense that I think we have over the next 25 years, we have this new generation of people that literally grow. I mean, there's going to be professional gamers, right? I mean, this whole culture of gaming is going to be massive. And if Magic can survive through that, whether it's through paper and online or whatever, as long as it stays in the pop culture and the gaming culture landscape, I think Magic will always have a bright future. But I do agree with you that the relationship with the cards, meaning modern cards, like fetch lands, right? Like, what kid handles fetch lands and has the same feeling as the guy who in 93 opened a pack of Arabian when Magic was this thing that you bought at hobby stores? Like, it's just not the same thing, right? The whole relationship to the game is different. So yeah, it's tough to say. And what my hope is that in 20 years, you know, Magic will have sort of ensconced itself in gaming culture such that these sort of high-end collectibles are seen as like holy grails, like, oh man, you know, like an achievement unlocked, right? I'm hoping that that's how the gaming cultural sort of, or gaming culture identifies with these products or with these collectibles.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you. In fact, one of the guys just said in the channel is Magic in the side of thing. And which it absolutely was. We're now
we lost you there for a second. Could you go back to that statement?
Sorry, one of the guys just said in the channel saying that Magic in the 90s was an outsider thing, which is completely correct. And you're saying now that gaming in the modern day world is an insider thing, which it is.
Yeah,
it is. Everyone games nowadays, whether it be on, you know, on their mobile device, whether it be on their computer or whether it be on Xbox and PlayStation, and the density of consoles, particularly in houses. So I'm in a chat group for graded Magic cards, and we talk about everything and things like that. But yesterday's discussion was on people buying graded Sega games from the 90s. That was something that blew my mind. I did not know that existed. People buy graded cartridges.
Which are, I'm assuming, you're like still in the box.
Yeah, well, people get them graded both ways. They can be graded out of the box or graded in the box. Yeah, this was something that exactly that. It's that whole pop culture type thing and things like that. I never knew that existed until yesterday. But gaming is very much an insider thing now. Pretty much everyone games, and then everyone will have an attachment to some game going forward. And that can also be seen in like when I was learning to play in the 90s, I went to the comic shop and it was the same 10 guys there every Saturday and things like that. Nowadays, you can go to, here in Melbourne, there's 3 or 4 board game cafes where you can go and rent a table. They put tea and coffee on the table for you, and then you just grab board games out of the room. And these are successful, thriving businesses. You go there on a Saturday, and then you go back on a Saturday in 2 weeks' time, they will not be the same people. Because it's such a socially things, and probably the single biggest thing is it's groups of gender diverse people at those cafes as well. Like, we've all been to the game store, 40 dudes, 40 teenage boys,
yeah,
and things like that. Where you go to a board game cafe now, you know, there's people of all ages, there's boys, girls, everything there, and things like that. So it is. You're absolutely right. The emotional attachment will be different for gamers coming forward in the future, and it won't just be to the, you know, things to the old cards.
Let's talk about counterfeits for a second.
Actually, just before we jump off graded cards, I said before that I was going to touch on the fact that graded cards do go down.
Yes. I'm curious.
So this is the one thing that people don't. There's a thing in graded cards called population reports. So there is people out there. The best cart So the famous one, if you join the graded Facebook group, is the picture at the top of the graded Facebook group is the best set of Alpha Power 9. And it has two black labels in it, six quad 9.5s or quad 9.5 pluses and 10s, and then one basic 9.5 because one card only exists in basic 9.5. So he's got what's called the POP 1 set, so population 1, the first one and things like that. That set's worth a lot of money, an awful lot of money. Now, if somebody graded another 10 Black Lotus, or actually Alpha 10 Black Lotus, or even mythically now a black label 10 Black Lotus, that guy would lose his Alpha Black Lotus. I hear numbers of like $500,000 kicked around for that. If a card got graded better than that, or even tied with that, the value of that card would go down significantly. Because there would be one better, or the other way around, there is one that's tied with it, for example. And this is why there's such a big disparity in cost between the Alpha Black Lotus and the Beta Black Lotus, because in Beta there is three, Alpha there is one. So hence why there was a documented sale of $100,000 for the 10 Beta Black Lotus in November last year. But you know, the price that Brian Norshetti said for the Alpha one was about $500,000. Wow. So and this gets interesting when you get into other sets. So for example, Arabian Nights, there's a card in Arabian Nights that was not available in quad 9.5 until about a week ago, and it was about a month and a half, 2 months ago, and it was Fish Liver Oil Light. A common. So the guy who's got the best Arabian Nights set, and he's got like of the 63 tens, he's got 61 of the 10. So that, you know, that tells you how good his set is. He only had a basic 9.5. So when somebody fluked, and it really is a fluke, to get a 9.5 quad 9.5 Fish Liver Oil Light, they offered it to him for a couple of grand. Because it's population one, and he turned it down on the reason that it's a common. There probably will be another one graded up at that level sometime in the future. When there's only one of them, sure, it's probably worth a couple of grand. But when there's two of them, it becomes a $500 card.
Wow. So there is this sort of variance in just graded stuff coming somewhat out of the woodwork that can throw things off a little bit.
Especially with the interest in graded moving to interest in graded in the last 12 to 18 months, particularly with Arabian Nights, Antiquities, and Legends. So BGS, who are the Beckett Grading Services, are the most common Magic baseline. They have a service called Non-Guaranteed. The wait time on is between 10 and 14 months. So you send your cards, and then 10 to 14 months later, you get graded. So there's a huge backlog of particularly commons and uncommons there. And that was the other reason this guy chose not to buy that card, was because there's likely to be 10, 15, 20 more of that card sitting in BGS's back things. So if you were to look at buying, say, a 10 Tabernacle, for example, well, there's not going to be any Tabernacles sitting in the there's 5-10 Tabernacles, by the way. There's not going to be any Tabernacles sitting in the backlog, because the rules of the backlog is you're only allowed to submit cards that are worth under $500 into that backlog. So there's no expensive stuff sitting in the backlog, but there's going to be a lot of common.
And there's no way to know, right? There's no record to know what's in the backlog.
No, absolutely not. Like the people who've got the cards know, because they can look to their Beckett site, but no one else. Yeah.
Interesting. So there's a, and is there even a way to know there are X number of cards in the backlog? Like, can someone go, okay, hey, guy, like, can you look and see there's 50 cards in BGS, or no one has any idea?
No.
What's, no. Wow, interesting.
I don't even know if BGS knows.
Wow. So in a year, there very well could be a whole new set of stuff that's introduced into the market.
That is correct. Every day. So if you're trying to collect the set like I am, I'm 5 cards off completing my set. So I go and check those 5 cards probably about once a week to see if any more of them have been graded. Because the cards I'm missing at the moment are almost exclusively Hang on, I'm just going to look. I think they're all commons now. I think I have every uncommon and rare. I know I've got one rare. So I'm after four commons. And so I'm just living here waiting to crank their way through that backlog. Because I've actually suspended grading on the 10-day service, which was the most popular, in order to allow people to them to catch up on their backlogs. And so I go and check the pop reports about once a week and see if anyone's graded any of them. And I know for a fact that one of those cards got graded about a week and a half ago. So I'm just waiting for it to turn up on someone for sale. It'll turn up on eBay or it'll turn up on Facebook group and things like that, because it was one of about 60 Arabians cards graded at once. Including multiples of the same cards. So if you just see, 93 new cards turn up in the pop report, that somebody just graded a whole set. But if I see 60 cards turn up in the pop report and they've got five deserts and four Moorish cavalries and things like that, that's a dealer who's shipped a whole bunch of stuff off to be sold to be graded.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you could math it out a little bit by taking the number of cards that were printed minus what you know is in the community and sort of minus what you own, et cetera, and you can sort of get a guesstimate as to, you know, what's going on. It's not going to be wholly accurate because cards are pulled out of boxes and basements, et cetera. Oh, but you can sort of get an idea.
Tiny. The numbers of graded cards are tiny. So like there's 6 million Arabian cards printed, I think, or 5 million, and there's only 9,000.
Oh wow!
So the numbers are tiny.
So and that definitely there's a lot of room there for new graded copies in the market. However, we're talking 9.5s here, which is, I guess, it's very rare to get a 9.5, right?
Yeah, very very. There's probably less than of that 9,000. I think there's probably under 1,000 of that 9,000. A 9.5. I focus on 9, so I could tell you exactly there's 2,736 9 graded cards in Arabian Nights, because I've got a spreadsheet that I keep updated. I'm that nerdy. I have a spreadsheet.
Hey, listen, you're in the land of nerd spreadsheets here. Plenty of us keep nerd spreadsheets. But so interesting. So, and it's important to note that graded, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but anything under what 9 is kind of in the realm, like between a 6 and an 8.5 is kind of considered whatever, and not many people bother with it, right?
At that level, it's this authenticity. The slab is giving more authenticity than any uplift. Sort of roughly in most people's mind, like a 9, an 8.5 or a 9 basic. Is sort of near mint plus 10%, quad 9 is 20-25%. Quad 9 plus plus, so that's like a very nice 9, is sort of like about 1.5 times the near mint price, sort of price. And then when you get into 9.5s, it really changes depending on how many of them there exist, what the set collectors on the market are looking for, and things like that. So I'm very comfortable talking about prices of sort of in the 9 stuff. But when we get to 9.5, that's when you have to go off and do a bit of research. And I've helped a few of the insiders get stuff graded recently. I've suggested that they get stuff graded and things like that. And I believe that I'm pretty sure that most of them have got returns around the sort of numbers that I'm talking. Locke got a couple of bazaars recently graded, and he ended up with about 10% difference in his sale price between his 9 basic and his 9.5 quad. Sorry, it's not his 9 quad. Not 9.5.
Cool. So quad 10 black labels. Before we move on to the other stuff, quad 10 black labels, like they do exist, right? You know some people that have quad 10s. And does the black label Alpha Lotus exist? No.
No.
It does not exist.
There is only one black lotus that is black labeled, and that's an unlimited one.
I'm sorry, say that again?
There's only one black label, Black Lotus, and that's an unlimited one.
Unlimited. Oh, so there is no Alpha or Beta one.
So there's one 10, which is a gold label 10, an Alpha. There's 3 in Beta, and there's 4 in Unlimited.
Plus one black label Unlimited.
I think the 4 includes the black label.
Includes the black label.
Check.
Wow. So there's no black label Alpha or Beta in existence. But there are black label Alpha Beta Moxa. Is that correct?
So in Alpha, there is a to Strawler Black Label. In beta, I actually don't know beta Black Labels that well. So in Alpha, there's 9 Black Label cards in Alpha. There's 1 in Arabian Nights, and I think there's about 20 in beta.
Are those spread out amongst different people, or is there a couple of guys that own all them? A couple of people?
There's a guy who the best alpha set.
Right.
So he has most of the alpha black labels. There is a guy who collects Royal Assassins, and he has the black label alpha, the black label beta, and the black label summer magic Royal Assassin. The picture exists online. So he's a member of the graded group. There is a guy, I'm told, I don't actually know him, but I see him post from time to time, who collects black label cards. So I presume he has a chunk of the black labels as well. So yeah, we're talking a handful of guys who have the black label stuff.
Wow, fascinating.
There is only 90 or 100 black label magic cards in total. And I don't believe any card exists twice.
Those are worth a literal fortune, I'm sure.
Literally whatever the seller wants to ask for them and what a buyer is willing to pay. So there's a black label demonic tutor beta that Brian Enns listed for sale recently. And he said, somebody give me offers. And I know that he publicly snapped decline 15K. That's how the black labels are.
Amazing. Yep.
And they exist in Summer Magic.
It's a fascinating world, man. I think the thing that fascinates me, most of you guys know each other, right? I think that's what's so interesting is the community aspect. Like, I don't want to say you guys are a cabal, because it's not a cabal in the negative, but you're kind of your own little graded mafia almost, you know?
Yeah, I guess there's I'm not 100% sure I'm comfortable on that term, but yes.
Okay, it's a campfire game. How about that? That's a little friendly.
Yeah, and remember what I pointed out there is guys like me who are collecting graded cards because of their emotional attachment and things like that with them. Like, I want a set of Arabian Nights. I've never had a set of Arabian Nights. So that was why I decided to keep a graded one, and then I found my little niche, which is Quad 9, and things like that. There's also guys who are buying them purely for investment. There is literally people who are buying very high-end graded cards for investment.
Yeah, and that's something that's a sort of a new development, right? Given what's happened over the past year and a half.
Yes and no. So there was an article in, I think it was Forbes a week or two ago, about a guy who is in financial investment services in New York who has been buying graded Lotuses apparently for several years because he saw them coming. So that guy's way more advanced than me. I will find that link and drop it into the inside of Discord.
That would be amazing. Yeah. Okay, counterfeits.
Sure.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So again, what we're conventionally told is that counterfeits are scary, but they're less scary in the vintage world, more scary in the day-to-day blue collar world of modern and standard or modern foils or whatnot, not the high end, because it's so difficult to replicate those old cards with modern counterfeits. And because the community in high end is so savvy at picking that up, is that generally correct? Is pretty much the high end world kind of counterfeit safe in the sense that that stuff's really just not going to get through the hands of most people?
Yes, that's exactly it always amazes me sometimes in like the high-end magic group or graded group and things like that. You see people post pictures of moxes and things like that going, can you tell me if this is fake? And it's like, well, if you don't know what you're buying at that level, don't buy it, or find somebody who does know what you're buying and get them to look at it. So I've looked at half a dozen moxes and lotuses around here in Australia for people to basically help them out with the authentication. I carry a loop. I have one in my work backpack and I have one in my magic bag. In my magic bag, I have a set of cards from basically every set that I'm concerned about from a printing perspective. So I have a basic forest. I have a beta. I can't even remember what my beta card is. Probably another land as well. I have a lot of land. I have an unlimited lightning bolt. I have a revised dark ritual. You know, stuff that people aren't going to counterfeit. And I have one from every printing going through to stuff that I'll buy, like Arabian Nights and things like that. And so I'm very comfortable and very good at detecting fakes from that respect. Have I ever been fooled? Not that I know of, but, you know, would I say that my collection is 100% fake proof? No, because I've got a lot of cards as well, which is exactly what you're right. Like, if somebody sold me an example that was used on the Cartel Aristocrats podcast a while ago, one of the boys, 25 ley lines of the void. And only when he was putting them in the case, like 3 days later, one of them was fake. So when you're buying bulk numbers of a modern card, it would be off 1, 2, 5 card, like, you know, to things like that. But if somebody walks up to me with an underground sea or a mox or something like that, I'm going to go over there with a fine tooth comb. An example of 25 ley lines of the void is worth about the same as a played underground sea.
Yeah.
So getting, I'm not a counterfeiter, obviously, but if I was trying to counterfeit, I'd be absolutely looking at that mid-level value stuff, because it's easy to inject in the market and people don't look at it very tightly. So yes,
right.
In vintage, we are more. Now, the thing in vintage that people should be watching out for is rebacks, particularly in beta. Just today I was posting in the Discord about how to spot a reback, because somebody dropped a picture of quite a shonky looking alpha mox, and somebody said, oh, it could be a reback. And I was like, no, it can't be a reback, because the thing that people don't realize is reback cards come from collector's edition. So somebody's sanded off or peeled apart a collector's edition card and then glued to a real magic card.
Just to clarify, because some people might not. When you say sanding off, you're saying they sand off the back of the card, the back That's of the great. Collector's edition card, right? And then they slap on a beta back.
Normally a back, yeah. Probably from that sort of vintage realm and things like that. So you sand down the back of the CE card, and you sand off the front of a real magic card, and then glue them together.
Glue them together. Got it.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of tests that can spot that. People talk about the light test, and people talk about like the bend test. Don't bend test your cards, people, and things like that. Seriously, look, cards fail after an amount of time of being bended, like even just a natural thing. So my Beta Lotus has a tiny little crease in the front of it from somebody bend testing it. It's not a reback, and the reason I know it's not a reback is because in CE cards, because they were printed differently, they actually used a different print film production, and they actually inverted the mana cost. So if you have a look if you're in the inside of Discord and then you have a counterfeit check, just today I've posted pictures of a couple of moxes and an ancestral recall. Now, in those days, the casting cost, the CMC, the mana symbol, wasn't in the middle of the little circle that goes around. It was offset to the left or to the right. Now, I can tell you for Black Lotus and 4 of the 5 Moxes, it is offset to the... I'm going to say this correctly. It is offset to the... in beta, it is offset to the left. Yes, I'm right, left. And then in CE cards, it's offset to the right. So that means that when you get a reback, the mana symbol isn't looking the correct way. And I posted pictures of a Black Lotus, a Mox Emerald, and an Ancestral Recall earlier today. For this, you can actually, when you actually look at them up close, because they're side by side cards, you can actually see the mana symbol offset. Now, the gotcha here is that Mox Jet is the other way around. so whatever it was in beta, it gets flipped in CE. So when you get a reback card, it's still, because it's still got the front of a CE card, it is flipped around. It is around the wrong way. So you can spot rebacks. I'm now at the point where I can spot a reback across the table because of this. because you can actually see it, things like that. But for an untrained person, that would probably be the scariest thing for buying. Now, and also the other biggest thing is Redax only exist in alpha and beta, because there is no C cards from Arabian Nights and things like that. So anything right. that feels off in those other sets is just going to be an out-and-out fake. Well, it could be, well, particularly with, so alpha, beta, unlimited, Arabian Nights, Antiquities were all single print run sets. So one day printing, whole lot done. Revised, Legends, the Dark, and onwards are all multi-day print runs. So they either used multiple print facilities, which Revised is an example of. They used multiple days of printing, which Legends is an example of. Or they used multiple countries, for example. So 4th edition, we had printings happen in America and Belgium. And then when they went to do another print run in America, we ended up with an alternate 4th edition where they used a different print product over top of the ink. And so the little factoid that people may or may not know is there is a printing of 4th edition out there that doesn't glow under UV light. And it's called alternate 4th. So that's actually another one, by the way. Real magic cards glow under UV light. So there's a lot of ways you can protect yourself. And so again, on Cartel Aristocrats, they said they just actually can wave a UV light over the back of a big pile of cards and spot fakes. So there is multiple ways to find fakes. And if you're going to be moving a lot of cards or dealing in high end, I just encourage you to learn, practice, pick people's brains.
Do you have any concern about the quality and number of increasing number of fakes, counterfeits that are coming into the market? Do you think that's a real concern to the game?
If they can't fake cards that were printed in 1906 for cigarette card things, which are a single stamp press print card, they can't print a multi-press print run like Magic that was printed in the 90s. So at the end of the day, fakes exist for comic books. Fakes exist for all the old collector's cards from the 30s and 40s and things like that. And people have developed checks and balances and tests to prove authenticity for those. And we are doing the same for Magic cards nowadays.
Yeah, I hear the argument about fakes and it's becoming more and more a problem. And I have yet to hold a fake that wasn't obvious to me or wasn't, it didn't obviously raise an eyebrow if it was not a fake, but I felt it was like, this needs to be questioned. Like I've never held a fake and a real Magic card and it was indistinguishable.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So yeah. Long story short, don't get too concerned with fakes. I've noticed this recently, the past couple months or two, there's been a lot of hype around, a lot of fear over fakes and whatnot. And while no one wants fakes, it's I don't think it's as bad of an issue as people think.
You gotta remember that also the biggest thing is that the people who are trying to make fakes are trying to make fakes that you can use in Magic tournaments, which are going to be double sleeved across the table.
Yeah.
So the threshold for them to pass a fake off and the threshold for them trying to hand me a graded on my desk right now, I've got a graded oubliette and things like that. So the threshold for them to get past BGS with that, and I'm not saying that the vendors have not graded fakes. They have. Both BGS and PSA have graded a fake in the past. It's been known. And they make mistakes as well. So you end up with cards upside down, you end up with cards with wrong labels. Just last week there was a guy got four soul rings from the vault. Soul Ring was in, graded, and they got graded as Summer Magic cards. it's a good way to blow the pot report. Went from 2 to 6 in one day, and things like that. So these companies are not infallible, but the threshold for them is so much higher because it's so much harder to have under their microscopes, under their bright lights and things like that to pass. So yes, graded cards. And one of the boys just said that he started collecting graded because of the perceived value and the authenticity in the world of crappy fakes. They're not 100%, like they're not 100 to 5 decimal zeros, but a graded card is to 4 zeros or 3 zeros, or you know, it is 100% not, you know, the examples of fakes being graded as ones and twos over, you know, there's 85,000 Magic cards being graded ever, and we as a community have managed to find one or two examples.
So we're going over a little over an hour. I want to make sure we touch on the Australia market just to give people an idea of that. I think it's very interesting, but we have maybe about 10, 15 more minutes. So in case people haven't guessed it by now, you do live in Australia. You mentioned that earlier on the cast, and you're originally from New Zealand, correct?
That is correct.
So I've had the opportunity to meet and chat with some other folks from Australia, and it is, I mean, you guys really have kind of your own market ecosystem. And the reason why I think this is relevant is because, you know, you buy cards from the US, people, you know, may want to ship cards to Australia, they may think there's arbitrage, etc. Because you guys really have, it's its own world, really, because you're so remote. So you guys kind of have kind of your own pricing and your dollar value. You know, there's a currency exchange difference. So can you just briefly talk about the Australian market and how it differs from the rest of the West?
Yeah, so there's sort of like three categories of people down this part of the world. There's the people who just go to their altars. Now, everything I've seen, we have in New Zealand, there's like each city in New Zealand has a gouge in quite a few smaller community LGSs. So there's sort of like two or three big ones in New Zealand, and only one of them really all the rest of work on the theory of you come into the store and they'll have good stock, but you've got to come into the store. So that's probably the biggest thing between New Zealand and Australia is and over here in Australia, one of the stores has a reasonable presence and another store has an online presence, but I've never managed to successfully buy a card from it. But yeah, again, the stores are generally more of that you come in and see what stock they have, or you email them asking them for a card. They don't have online shipping cards. We don't have anything like TCG Player. The closest is eBay or Facebook. And this is where I'm going to go into the second part, was the Facebook groups are huge down here. Like obviously the high-end and market ones and things like that, which exist on a worldwide scale, but both New Zealand and Australia have very, very active marketplaces just for Australians in New Zealand. So I'm in both of them because I lived on both sides of the Tasman in the recent times. But they have the geo war. Like if you try and like if you're an American or something like that and try and join the New Zealand marketplace, you'll just get told no. We don't do foreign shipping and things like that, which means that the prices become quite inbred like things. So a lot of people use SCG as pricing. So say, for example, I wanted to buy today a Scalding Tarn. If I posted in either the New Zealand or the Australian Facebook groups, everyone would just expect me to pay SCG 1-to-1. So what that means is if it's, I don't even know what the price of a Scalding Tarn is, $80 on Scarcity US, I would expect to pay and be expected to pay $80 in New Zealand, which is quite a bit less than the Star City price because of the currency conversion and things like that. But it's also more than what, it's less than or more than what it would cost you to bring it in from Star City, obviously, or from TCG Player, for example.
You guys keep it contained because you don't want arbitrage exploitation?
No, it's nothing as complicated as it's literally people want to be able to pay via local bank accounts and things like that. Obviously paying, if we were to pay, so the other big thing is that people may not realize this for us. Down here, if we pay retail, obviously it's going out as goods and services. But if people ask us to pay gift, there's a $7 charge on paying gift for currency conversion, and then we absolutely get caned and using PayPal's exchange rate. Because I'm paying in Australian dollars, I pay a $7 fee to gift payment to you, plus whatever the fees are, if it's more than that, if I use my credit card, for example. And then I probably lose 2 percentage points on the exchange rate as well to PayPal. So cards look very expensive coming from America, which is why I tend to use people I get stuff sent to people and then do one payment to them, and things like that. So when I'm stuff arbitrage, like, well, not arbitrage, but you know, when I'm buying stuff out of America, obviously the PayPal gifting fees don't hurt me as much when I'm buying more expensive stuff. So if I just wanted to buy, I don't know, a Colligan's Command today, it is cheaper for me to walk down the store and pay full retail at the store who'll have it in stock than it is for me to order it from the States by the time I pay, like, even off like the high-end Magic Group or anything like that, or Sick Deals, for example, because often I'm going to pay $10 shipping on top of that, and that's in US dollars, which I then have to convert to Australian dollars. It just, it spirals out of control very rapidly.
So how do the stores get inventory for non-standard stuff, older, like modern and whatnot? Because they have to import that inventory, right?
No, it's
there's enough of a global supply over the years. So
in New Zealand, the biggest store in New Zealand, the owner of that regularly goes to basically all the APAC Grand Prix and probably up to the odd American one as well. So he buys, like, he'll buy dual lands and things like that when he's there. Or often what he'll do is, like, if he's going to a modern Grand Prix in Japan, for example, is he'll spend 3 months in New Zealand buying fetch lands and then go up to Japan, and vendors there, he'll, Japan's a terrible example, so we'll go to China. At China, he'll drop all his fetch lands off with them, and he'll grab the dual lands, for example, and then take them back to New Zealand. So he's doing the slower arbitrage opportunity of playing the, you know, playing the dealer game and things like that. But yeah, for anything that's New Zealand and Australia both got unlimited onwards, so the really old stuff exists. Obviously, there's people like me who have moved stuff into the country via postage over the years. So the stuff exists in Australia, but for that modern stuff and things like that, that's all just been cracked locally, domestically, I would suspect. And there's three or four insiders who are based here in Australia. And I would expect that their comments are the same. Yeah, if you can move a chunk of cards at once, you basically remove the shipping costs.
Interesting.
By far and large, New Zealand and Australian people buy off other New Zealand and Australian people.
So that's good, and that seems very, very healthy for the economy, right? Because there's less, you know, there's less. I guess it's hard to compare the U.S. Such a massive market, but, like, you know, for smaller territories, if they run the risk of throwing things off if they start doing massive imports or exports or whatnot. But if it's kind of one giant circle, you know, it's good for the economy, good for the local economy.
Yeah, the export from Australia and Australia is Portal Three Kingdoms.
That's the hottest import.
No, the export.
Oh, the export. Okay, because you guys got most of it or a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe the vast majority of Australia.
Interesting.
Yep.
So unfortunately, if anybody wants to do business in Australia, you have to be a local. You can't. I guess if you do what I think Jeremy did, if you're willing to hop on a plane and fly over to the country, then you can do business, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with that, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And obviously, we have traditionally two Grand Prix a year. So Grand Prix Melbourne's coming up. In 2.5 months. So I would expect there'll be 2 to 3 American dealers here for that based on the last two Grand Prix. So I believe Tales of Adventure are coming down, and Grey Ogre will come down from Singapore, Taiwan, wherever. Yeah, Singapore, wherever they're based, because they are always here. Ben's a fixture on the APAC circuit. But yeah, other than that, but I do wonder what those American, like the guys from Tails and things like Ed came down for GP Sydney, whether they are treating it like a North American pre where they're primarily trying to buy cards, because getting cards to Australia, you know, you have to deal with the whole excess baggage and things like that, or whether they're using an opportunity to buy cards, to sell cards here, because our prices generally are more competitive because of the region locking.
Or it could just be a combination. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know too many of the West, the US groups that go out there. So
yeah, the other big thing is they, because of their system, they've actually made it, they've incentivized dealers to come to Australia, because it used to be that Australian GP would have the two Australian shops and the one New Zealand shop as 3 dealers only. But with the new system where you buy your booth based on a cost and then you get so many points, when if you achieve enough points, you get a discount. With Sydney earlier on this year, they halved the price of the costs of booths compared to what an American Grand Prix was. And they also made it like you got the most amount of points for coming to Sydney. Like anywhere in the world, Sydney was the most amount of points. So I think you started getting discounts on the number of your Grand Prix boots if you got 10 points, and Sydney on its own was worth 5 points.
Fascinating.
So they are incentivizing people to come to here.
Interesting. Well, Kip, Adrian, this has been an awesome conversation, man. We're running almost an hour and a half, so I don't want to keep it going too long. There's so much more to talk about. I feel like we should extend this maybe to a part two sometime and do it again for sure.
Yeah, not a problem. Yeah, I absolutely enjoyed talking. It's quite interesting. I noted today that people haven't asked anywhere near as many questions as normally when you and Chaz are on. Normally they come at a million miles, so they're either all tuned
out. Well, it's also 11 o'clock at night for most people. So we got a little late. It's not morning time. But I do want to make sure that we wrap up on a couple of picks, because obviously we do that every cast. And I know you had a pick that is actually related to the topic tonight. I'll go through mine really quick and then we can go to yours. My picks for this cast, I'm going with Shocklands. That is the Return to Ravnica Shocks. Yes, I said it, Shocklands. I do not believe they're going to be in Guilds of Ravnica. I've been talking to folks. I haven't been gathering secret intel or any insider information, but just in conversations I've had with people and kind of looking at the markets, I have a sense that they are not going to be printing Shocklands in Guilds of Ravnica. Obviously, it's pure speculation on my part, but that is my sense. At which point the RTR Shocks, I think, have room to grow by about 20% possibly, if not more. I definitely think that if they're not reprinted, there will be hype around the Shocks. So yeah, I think you should get Shocks now. You can acquire them fairly cheap because people are scared they're going to get printed. My other pick this week is a little foil for Legacy. It's an uncommon called Rebuild. It's showed up on interests in the market movement. It's at around $8 now market price. And on TCG, it looks like, I don't know if it was bought out or not, but the cheapest price on TCG is $15. This is an interesting little blue card that lets you return all artifacts to their owner's hands for a blue and a two colorless, and it also cycles for two mana. Seems like a EDH gold, in my opinion, and obviously it's been moving on interest. So it's a vintage card. So Rebuild foils, I think those could easily be a $20 foil, and Shocklands, in my pick. So Adrian, what you got for us?
So my pick was around basically the topic around graded cards. I've spotted something that's a massive hole in the market in the fact that the dark has barely been graded. So some cards have 100 graded copies in the dark, which is like Mazebeth and things like that. But you can actually mathematically only make one set of the graded dark at the moment. So people are buying the dark sets and they are selling online. You see them in the whole set collectors group in the high-end markets and things like that, but people are not yet grading the dark, so that will come. That's going to be the next thing. So if you can get your hands on mint, and I mean proper mint dark cards, whether it be commons, uncommons or rares, put them away. I think in 2 years time you'll get quite a large return selling to the people who are looking to grade them. Because at the moment, there's only about 800 the dark cards graded, and the set is about 100 cards. And then you've got guys like me who are going to finish our Arabian Nights, we're going to finish our Antiquities, skip Legends, because that's just horrendous. And then the dark will be the next thing. And people will be looking to buy. And the threshold I'm talking about is very high for mint cards. But yeah, if you could buy, if you put aside really mint commons, uncommons, and from the dark, it doesn't matter what. I think you'll get very good returns in the future. For example, a graded 9 common from Arabian Nights is between $50 and $200. So, yeah, there's massive returns there.
Awesome. All right, guys, you got it from Adrian. Go buy mint copies of dark cards, regardless of rarity, because those are looking nice from the high-end community. So, cool. All right, guys, well, thanks so much. A little bit longer cast. Super informative, and I thought this was a great conversation to have. Adrian, thanks so much. If you guys have any questions or if you want to talk to Adrian, you can obviously hit him up, DM him in the Discord. If you are interested in, you know, Australian market, or you know, if you want to talk to him about how you can maybe even sell off some of your graded cards, you want to get cards, anything involving high end, hit him up. I'm sure he'd be happy to chat with you. And This was cool, man. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me. Nice point.
All right, guys. Good night.